Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Tuesday afternoon, October 22nd. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. Some secondary sports are enjoying an increase in popularity. We'll talk about them in our next segment. But right now, the Internal Revenue Service is announcing its adjustments for next year's filing season. Joining us now on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Elizabeth Bafardi, founder of Crescendo Financial Planners and co-chair of the Personal Financial Planning Forum for the Illinois CPA Society. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today. And for those of us who wake up at 6 a.m. on New Year's Day to begin the process of filing our taxes for 2024, what can we expect in the new income tax forms for this year?
It's going to be about the same as last year. The difference is that they adjust the brackets for inflation. So this year, the brackets went up about 2.79, 2.8% in comparison to 2024.
And then historically speaking, one of the major issues in this presidential campaign and that the next White House will have to grapple with is that the 2017 tax law sunsets. And normally before there is a potential big change in tax policy, does the IRS form essentially stay the same by design?
A really interesting question, because the forms changed quite a bit when we went to the current tax regime that we have. So I'm not sure. I'm assuming that the forms may change back to what they used to be. But that's something that we'll have to wait and see for.
And then as I joke about you getting to start on your taxes immediately on New Year's Day, just like Ned Flanders on The Simpsons. But if you want to do some tax housekeeping and get prepared for these new forms starting in 2025, when all the paperwork is mailed out to you, what are some things you can do right now?
So the new forms, when we go back to the old tax regime that we used to have back in 2017, that doesn't actually happen until 1/1/2026. So we've got a little bit of time. The thing that I keep telling everybody is look at where you think you're going to end up this year and even in 2025, and think about doing Roth conversions, because if you do Roth conversions in 2026, assuming we revert back to the old rates and rules, you're going to be converting probably at a higher rate than what you're converting right now.
And then what if you want to potentially limit your income tax hit, you know, as an individual or as a family? Can you go back into your withholding and maybe withhold a little bit more federal income tax just so that number may not be nearly as eye-popping when you actually do the math next year?
So you can change your withholding on your wages at any time. Usually you just have to talk to your HR person and ask them, you know, you might have to fill out a form type of thing. The more exemptions that you have, the less they're going to withhold. And the less exemptions you have, the more they're going to withhold. And then two, if you withhold based on married or single, that's going to change the withholding as well. But when we get to 2026, assuming that we're reverting back, you're definitely going to want to take a look at those withholding rates, because that's what messed everybody up in 2018 and even a little bit in 2019 when we reverted to the tax regime that we're in right now.
Elizabeth Bafardi, founder of Crescendo Financial Planners, co-chair of the Personal Financial Planning Forum for the Illinois CPA Society in Oak Brook. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, some second-tier sports are on the upswing.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
While the NFL, NBA, and MLB remain the kings of professional sports, there are some next-level leagues making inroads. Plus, college sports and activities like pickleball pickleball are gaining in popularity. Let's talk about what's gaining traction with Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verterre Group in Chicago. Tim, thank you for joining us today. At the top of the list is that Major League Soccer appears to have turned a major corner as far as its drawing power and public perception are concerned. It broke a lot of attendance records league-wide. Unfortunately, the Chicago Fire did not make that cut. But what is driving the growth in the sport of Major League Soccer, especially as a broadcast property?
Yeah, look, Rob, the ascendance of Major League Soccer has been quite something, especially over the last 10 years or so. Chicago Fire fans, like myself, have been long-suffering, frankly, no playoffs in the last number of years, and bouncing around from stadium to stadium and various scenarios there. But the league in total really is on a tremendous upswing in terms of valuations of the franchises, the Lionel Messi effect coming over to play with in Miami, and record-breaking attendance. It seems to be firing on all cylinders, I think aided and abetted by international competition and just a sheer upswing of interest in the international leagues as well as here in, domestically in the United States. But it's also a very interesting dynamic that the investment in MLS teams, the franchises, they're actually not franchises, they're actually owned and operated subsidiaries of the league itself. It's wholly owned by the league. Is actually emblematic of what's going on elsewhere too in other sports. You're seeing a tremendous influx of private equity money in all kinds of sports, the big ones as well as smaller and more even fringe sports. It's becoming an asset class, pro sports is, and relatively dramatically.
Now, Tim, for the last 30 years, I had been hearing that soccer was about to become the next big thing in the United States and become as a big of a deal in the U.S. as it is in other parts of the world, just based on the number, the sheer number of kids who play soccer either as a summer sport or as an extracurricular or at school. But it never really happened. But is it the proliferation of international coverage and the ease at which Americans can access international coverage, that kind of turbocharge American perception of soccer?
Well, I'll pass by your blind spot of 1981 when the Chicago Sting won the NASL championship. But so there's no question that that soccer as a participatory sport is probably at an all-time high in this country. I think really I think you also have to put it in perspective, right? In terms of major league status, right? I mean, I think that that definition, those big four sports, and can soccer or has soccer cracked into those that big four kind of status? I think the reality is you have to look at professional sports in a much more narrow business-like environment to quote unquote call it a success. Right, Major League Soccer right does not drawing nearly 11.5 million fans total across the league is certainly not Major League Baseball statistics, but in terms of its relative base of consumer, it's huge. Same with the WNBA. Same with the National Women's Soccer League, the Chicago Red Stars. These are leagues and propositions in sports that are looking at smaller fan bases, but actually with maximum opportunities to generate revenue on a whole different bunch of fronts. They don't need tens of millions of fans per se, per team, to be financially successful anymore with controlling their own stadiums and their own broadcast and streaming operations and those kinds of things. So I think the relative definition of what a quote-unquote successful league is definitely changing. And I think MLS is probably the leader of that new age pack.
Now, Tim, I'll have you know, we speak highly of Karl-Heinz Granitza here on the Noon Business Hour, and we also respect Der Sting's championship back in 1981. Thank you for joining us, Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verterre Group in Chicago. Coming up next, there's now an opening date for the Universal Epic Universe Park in Florida.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The newest theme park in Orlando, Universal Universal Epic Universe Park is set to open in May. Let's preview what's on the way with Andrew Stillwell, writer and podcast host, Coaster101.com in Charlotte. Thank you for joining us today. May 22nd, 2025, that is when the Epic Universe Park opens in Orlando at Universal Studios. And what can people expect when the park opens its doors next spring?
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me. This is a theme park that has nothing to this scale has been built in so many years, and they're going to have five distinct worlds. They're going to have Celestial Park, that's kind of this central hub, and then they've got what they're calling portals to Dark Universe, which is the Universal Monsters, How to Train Your Dragon, Super Nintendo World, and then there is another edition of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. So four really strong IPs centered around the Celestial Park.
And it also sounds like, Universal Orlando has been around for 35 years, but it can now go toe-to-toe or ride-for-ride with the other theme parks, plural, in Orlando, Walt Disney World.
I think so, yeah. It is an experience, like I said, nothing of this scale has been built in a number of years. This gives Universal a total of three amusement parks plus their water park, Volcano Bay. And I know when Universal was talking earlier this week, they said the goal is to make this kind of a week-long destination. Definitely, I don't want to call it a shot across the bow at Disney, but definitely there's potential there.
How does the Universal ecosystem in Orlando stack up with Walt Disney World? Because if you go to Disney World, you don't have to leave the property. You can go to a Disney hotel. You have Disney transportation taking you to other parks or restaurants, bars, shopping. Does that level of infrastructure exist inside Universal?
It does, as it is currently. They've got a number of resort hotels. They've got an entertainment district called City Walk. Epic Universe is going to be built a little bit down the road, but they do have transportation that will get you from those resort hotels to Epic Universe. Also going to be three new resort hotels as kind of part of that Epic Universe property. So it's not as all-encompassing and enclosed as Disney is, but the infrastructure is definitely there.
And then what's the price war like between Disney and Universal? Because the most recent story to come out of Disney as far as the theme park experience is concerned is that Lightning Lane, skip the line in the most popular rides feature that a lot of Disney fans say is rather price prohibitive as of late. Is this an opportunity for Universal to come in and say, look, you can get the same experience, but it's not going to cost an arm and a leg, maybe just an arm?
I think it might just be an arm. The Orlando parks, they're their own kind of unique animal. They are some of the most world-class theme parks in existence. They command the kind of the price point that it comes with them. Universal will, I will say with their kind of resort and hotel options, they're a little cheaper than Disney. Their properties are a little bit more modern. And plus at the their super deluxe resorts, you get the Universal Express access that I think is what you're referring to with Disney charging for. So it's all going to come out pretty evenly. But I think with the shiny new toy that Universal is unveiling next May, I think there definitely could be the argument for some price comparisons there.
Andrew Stillwell, writer and podcast host at Coaster101.com in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour, talking about the new park coming to Universal Orlando, opening next May.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The Chicago School Board postponing its meetings until December. America's top diplomat continues his efforts to forge a ceasefire in the Middle East. In Travel Tuesday, making your next vacation a more active affair. And we'll look at what history says about the impact of the World Series on financial markets. WBBM Business, the markets are mixed right now. The Dow down just a fraction. The NASDAQ is up 3, S&P 500 down 8, 70 right now at O'Hare, under partly sunny skies, south wind 15 miles an hour, gusting to 25, going up to 76 today, sunny skies, but could see some showers west of Chicago. The details in the complete AccuWeather forecast coming up. Our top local story on News Radio WBBM, Thursday's scheduled meetings of the Chicago Public School Board have been canceled. The Tribune reports the panel will next gather December 12th. 12th. That will be more than a month after 10 candidates have been voted in as part of the city's new partially elected, partially appointed school board. Israel is continuing its ground and air offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Meantime, the militant group launched rockets into central Israel hours before the U.S., the American Secretary of State, arrived in the country. The BBC's Jonah Fisher is in Jerusalem.
Any idea that this visit by Antony Blinken might pave the way for a ceasefire, or that we're a few steps before that might be realistic? But I think what they will be talking about is what Gaza might look like after a deal in terms of who will control it. Israel, of course, doesn't want Hamas to be involved in any administration. And then perhaps the most achievable thing that Antony Blinken could perhaps be looking at today with the Israelis is ways of getting more humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip.
Secretary Blinken is meeting today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are mixed right now, but they're moving up. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Ken Crawford, portfolio manager with Argent Capital in Clayton, Missouri. And Ken, when it comes to the market activity this week, is the rate on the 10-year yield, the 10-year Treasury yield, is that basically the equivalent of trying to run uphill with a heavy backpack on your back?
Well, it's been a little bit difficult of late, just as you said, Rob. I think one of the pressures that we've seen in the week, and you know, fully understanding that we're only in Tuesday, is that interest rates have risen, and that's put investors a little bit on the defensive, especially with regard to housing.
Was this considered a surprise when the interest rate cut announcement was made, that half point cut about a month ago? Was this did this take investors by surprise, or was this something that people were keeping an eye on and they knew it was coming?
I think it was a bit of a coin flip between a 50 basis point, half a percent, or 25 basis point, quarter percent cut. And after it was decided and the Fed went with 50, I think the focus on the part of investors was what happens next. So in their next meeting, do they cut another 25? Do they pause? Do they cut 50? And I think that's where some of the market action that you've seen of late has been focused.
And it's interesting because you do have some members of the Open Market Committee, or, you know, the WAGs call them, the Open Mouth Committee, already talking about that they will, or at least some members of that committee are going to say, that are saying that they want to cut interest rates at least a quarter point at successive meetings. How is that interpreted by investors? Because as we like to say, people like to talk, and it may not be the real story.
Well, I think that's kind of the crux. So I think investors are looking very closely at any data that is tied to inflation. I think if inflation is perceived as continuing to decline to, you know, towards the Fed glide path of 2%, expectations would be for interest rates to continue to be cut. If jobs data is stronger, if pricing is stronger, then investors kind of are in the back of their heels wondering, is the Fed going to pause? Because as I'm sure you and your listeners know, data dependency is something that the Fed always talks about. So if there is a belief that inflation is not in that kind of 2% glide path, I think investors might get worried that the Fed would back off on cutting interest rates.
Earnings season continues, and let's talk about General Motors. Shares up nearly 7.5%. It's a third quarter earnings report topped analyst expectations, and they raised their guidance for the rest of the year.
Right, and that was a bit of a surprise. The backdrop in auto sales has not been very good, especially with EVs. I'm sure people have heard about Tesla and cutting prices. So that was a positive surprise for GM.
And then very quickly, Philip Morris, they're up 8.1%. What is the meat of the Philip Morris business? Is it still a tobacco company, or have they diversified?
Well, they're trying to diversify, but they are still, in essence, a tobacco company. And what investors especially like is the tremendous cash flow that the company generates. So with lower interest rates, as we talked about, investors looking for yield, and stability in that yield makes Philip Morris that much more attractive.
Ken Crawford, Portfolio Manager, Argent Capital in Clayton, Missouri. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Travel Tuesday, making your next trip an adventure to remember.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's Travel Tuesday, and sometimes the goal of a vacation is to just chill, but other times it's to be active. Let's discuss the latter with Cindy Richards, editor-in-chief of SheBuysTravel.com in Chicago. Cindy, thank you for joining us today. And I understand the appeal of a vacation where you can just kind of relax, but after a while, the same five Bob Marley songs on the beach get kind of old, and you can only have so many rum drinks loaded with sugar. You want to do something else. You want to be active. You want to climb that mountain. You want to take that hike. What are some ways you can do to build a vacation around that desire to roam?
Well, they call it adventure travel, and it's a huge trend in travel these days, but it can mean a lot of different things. To some people, it means extreme sports. It's only an adventure if you're taking a 20-mile hike up the mountain before the end of the day. But there's also adventure travel that is just exploring adventurous places, like a cruise to Antarctica. It's super luxe, and you're on small ships, and you're really well taken care of, but you're seeing sights that only a handful of people in the world will ever get to see themselves.
But when you take these adventure trips, there's someone I know who has made it a goal to climb a mountain on every different continent. Not everybody does that. Not everybody has that skill level. But what are some places you can go, maybe in the U.S. or elsewhere in the world, to do things like maybe hike up a mountain or hike up a hill or just do some sort of physical activity and then just really enjoy the sights and the sense of accomplishment at the end?
Well, top of my bucket list is river rafting through the Grand Canyon. They're guided rafting trips, maybe a week long. You're camping out, but you're doing it with a guide, so it's safe. People who know the river and, know how to keep you safe. Machu Picchu is on a lot of people's bucket list to go there and see the great mountain. And, you can take a boat ride down the Amazon. There's all kinds of ways to be an adventurer. My recommendation is always, unless you really know what you're doing, is to go with a tour company where you have guides who know what they're doing. And I always tell people to make sure you read the reviews and make sure you read the information. Because if they tell you you need to be in top physical condition, believe them. Because it's a really seriously extreme sports kind of a trip. So don't go there if you're mostly a couch potato. You're not going to have a great time, and you could put yourself and other people in danger. These are serious trips for serious people, and you need to make sure that you're up for it before you book it.
It's Travel Tuesday, and we are talking about adventure tourism with Cindy Richards, editor-in-chief of SheBuysTravel.com in Chicago. You make a very good point, and that is you could see other people's vacation pictures on social media, and your eyes may get bigger than your head or your skill level, and you may say to yourself, I can do whitewater rafting, or I can do that hike, or I can climb that particular mountain, and then you get there, and then you realize, I can't do it. So when assessing your skill level, should you underestimate what you can do? And what kind of risk does that involve? And like, well, this wasn't a whole lot of fun.
Well, I think, we all learn by doing, right? I think what you have to remember is, the real, really good tour companies, they have, like if you're doing a biking trip through Switzerland, they're going to have a trail car, a van that can pick you up if you can't keep up, if you can't keep riding, if you fall, you get hurt, whatever. But I was just on a trip where a group went on a fairly rugged hike in Joshua Tree, and one of the women showed up. She was allergic to bees. It was, fall is bee season everywhere, right? So she was allergic to bees, and she was afraid to go on the hike, and they couldn't go because they only had one guide, and she said, I can't leave you sitting here with no EpiPen if you're allergic to bees, and everyone was not so happy with her. So you want to make sure that it really is the right thing, and I think you want to kind of build up to it. I mean, if you have never climbed a mountain, don't start by, you know, Mount Everest. You won't be happy. You'll overdo, and you'll hurt yourself. And definitely, if you're going to do one of these trips, make sure you have travel insurance. So if you do, if there is a mishap and you get hurt, you're going to be taken care of in whatever country and whatever place you are.
Cindy Richards, editor-in-chief of SheBuysTravel.com in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Personal Finance Wednesday, and still to come, examining the World Series effect on the markets.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Welcome to the Correlation Equals Causation segment on the Noon Business Hour. We got the World Series coming up later this week. Dodgers and Yankees. Which World Series champion would be better for the stock market? History offers some clues. Joining us to discuss the potential impact is Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And this is always a fun little thought exercise, going back through history and trying to determine what World Series winner could juice the stock market.
Well, that's right. And it actually follows the lead of perhaps a better known indicator called the Super Bowl indicator, which people, I think, are probably more familiar with, in which if the team that wins can trace its roots back to the original National Football Conference, then it's good for the stock market. If it traces back to the old American Football Conference team, then it's bad for the stock market. It's very similar for the World Series, though people don't really talk about it as much. But historically, the stock market has done better in the wake of a National League team winning the World Series than an American League. Now, I need to say right away that this is not a statistically significant correlation, but it is significant enough to at least get people's attention. I think over the next year, the market's up several percentage points more on average with a National League team winner than with an American League team winner.
Now, you know how I know, Mark, that this theory is bulletproof in every single way? And that is, in 1929, the American League Philadelphia Athletics defeated your Chicago Cubs. And we all know what happened just a few weeks later in October of 1929. So we're saying that maybe the entire Great Depression and everything that came with it could have been avoided if only the Cubs won the Fall Classic in 1929.
That's right. You've heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, it's always fun to go through these exercises because for the longest time, there was the old political maxim that was depending on how the then Washington Redskins did in their game the Sunday before the presidential election, it always determined how the vote would go the following Tuesday. I don't remember exactly what the correlation was, but I was working in Wisconsin in 2004, a swing state, and the result of that Sunday's game lined up with John Kerry winning the election the following Tuesday, and to the point where the Kerry campaign sent out a press release saying, Look at this. We're going to win based on the Washington football team result. And we all know what happened after that. And nobody crowed about that particular statistic anymore because it was eventually proven false.
Well, that's right. And what makes it fun is that there's just so much data out there, as we know, that if you spend enough time in torturing the data, you can find a correlation from anything. In fact, there's a professor at Caltech who went through a CD with all the data from the United Nations and all the individual accounts of individual countries, and he found that the correlation that is greatest with the S&P 500 is butter production in Bangladesh, which, of course, is a ridiculous on its face, but in terms of strict correlation, it was the highest of all.
Hang on a second. Butter production in Bangladesh. I just want to, you know, put that down on paper and then call my financial advisor. Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Thank you for joining us today.